we started thinking and talking about how to respond. And I think that the first thing to do is to say incivility or antagonism or clash is not the same thing as violence. And in fact, in many situations, it's absolutely necessary, ethically and politically. And so that's kind of part of where this started. And then Nina and I were arguing against specifically a turn in rhetorical theory that kind of warrants that dismissal of antagonism and clash, which is the invitational rhetoric turn, which I assume you've been reading about, which is basically this idea that rather than arguing with someone or trying to persuade them, that we should open up our hand and invite them into our space and then go into their space and figure out what we have in common. And I think that's very useful in some situations like teaching, but it's not so useful in Egypt when you're having a revolution. So, you know, it's just a matter of context and so on. But I think that our discipline is way too obsessed with the question of playing nice. And so that's kind of where I'm coming from.
And so, you know, just to say a little more about that, one of the ways in which this controversy played out was on our discipline's listserv, right? And plays out is maybe a gentle way of putting it. Could you say a little bit maybe about how civility was used in that context to suppress dissent or suppress alternate viewpoints?
Yeah,
sorry, go ahead.
Well, yeah, that's the irony of it, right? That civility can be used as a bludgeon. Basically, throughout all of world history, people, when they need to solve a social or a political problem, if they're suffering injustice and so on, they rise up and they have to confront the existing power in order to get things done a different way. That always involves a clash of some kind and at the very least, a disagreement, at the very most, an armed struggle of some sort. But on the NCA listserv, people who were opposed to our organizing the unconvention basically said that we were aligning ourselves with people who were really confrontational and inappropriate when it came to the association. And so I and many other people on the listserv just faced a strange onslaught of people basically saying, be more democratic by not raising this ruckus. And then the very president of the association, the legislative assembly that year was particularly interesting, and she said, what would people think about us if they walked by and saw us all arguing with one another? And my only response was they would probably assume that we had a democratic meeting going on. So it's really important for me in the context of the discipline and in life to be able to make distinctions between difference, controversy, clash, struggle, and coercion and violence. You know, those things exist kind of on a spectrum, and that it is a strange rhetorical move to take the word civility, and when they use that word civility, they collapse all of those other things into one thing. So if I'm having a disagreement with the president of the association, I'm being violent. If we're on a picket line, we're being violent. If we're having a very peaceful convention over there, it's violent because it's confrontational. So it's not definitionally rigorous, and it's not ethically either.
So one final question from me, and then I'll turn it over to the students. This NCA dispute is a bit of a microcosm of how civility and struggles over civility and incivility play out. Could you give us an example maybe from the current election or in social movements or maybe the Occupy or you said Egypt, where similar sort of appeals to civility are used to tamp down dissent?
Well, yeah, I guess I'll take as an example, I personally think that U.S. elections are not nearly uncivil enough. And so I don't know to what extent I want to comment on incivility in the election. I think there needs to be much more clash and controversy in elections, and people need to take actually different positions from each other. Mm. But I'll take the Chicago teachers' strike. The president of the Chicago Teachers Union, if you don't know, several weeks ago, 30,000 teachers in Chicago went on strike over their jobs, but also over the complete evacuation of public support for public education. And indeed, it was sort of the plan of the city to move in a whole regime of private schools and charter schools. It's a long story. But basically, they were fighting for the quality of public education, too. And it was a very effective weapon. Now, a strike as a weapon is not violent. It's just when you stop working. And so all the teachers didn't go to school. They had the support of families and parents. And so the regular business could not proceed as usual. And that gets in the way of things, and that puts pressure on leaders. So that's a form of coercion, but it's not violent, right? It's economic. Then, but I remember during that strike, the leader of the union, Karen Lewis, who is an amazing woman, she gave speeches. They were very rousing and rallying speeches. But the mayor of Chicago, Rahm Emanuel, said in one interview that she wasn't appropriately polite when she, and that she was just really brash, and he didn't understand why people were following her. And this revealed another dimension of this problem, which is about gender, that women are much more often likely to be told to be nice and be polite and behave yourself than men are likely to be told. So he was trying to discipline Karen Lewis in that. Of course, she didn't pay any attention to that whatsoever. but there is a sense in which any kind of massive or small public demonstration of difference will be decried. Now, who is doing the decrying? It's always the people who have power. The people who have power will always lament incivility. And they'll perpetrate a lot of incivility themselves, but I can take that up later. Hmm. Am I making sense?
Yeah, actually, yes. I do have a question about some of the things you were just talking about. You mentioned that a protest, such as a parade or a strike, could be seen as uncivil. Could you maybe talk about an example of a civil disagreement that... Because when I think of somebody standing on the street holding the sign, I see it as a pretty civil way of protesting. Mm-hmm. So can there be a disagreement and opposition and have it still be civil?
Well, sure. I think definitely. I would kind of say that all of the things that I described are within bounds of democracy, that they are appropriate things to do in a democracy, right? Mm-hmm. I'm kind of arguing that the word civil is limited in its meaning. I personally think if we did away with the word, it would help us a lot. Because then we could talk about whether the strike achieved its ends economically, or we can talk about how the strike confronted the mayor. We can talk about how the mayor confronted the leader. We don't and so all of that discourse about was that civil or was that not civil goes away, and what you have is the actual confrontation that needs to happen to make democracy happen. So I don't know if I'm subverting the entire point of the class, but I'm basically saying all of the things I described, maybe we can say they are civic, you know, but they would be, many of them would be regarded as uncivil. And I guess that's another thing, is that civility is in the eye of the beholder, right?
Yeah.
If you're somebody talking about the Boston Tea Party and you're a patriotic conservative, they weren't uncivil, right? But they stormed a boat and threw all the tea in the harbor, right? People have been called uncivil for much less, right? So it's in the eye of the beholder. What counts as civil or uncivil depends on who you are. And oftentimes, if you are a person who is trying to shut down a more vigorous democracy, you will call it uncivil. So I think of the word civil and uncivil as weapons.
Okay. So then where do you draw the line as... if everything could be seen as uncivil, or is it out when it becomes outside of the bounds of democracy, or?
And that's actually a great question. Again, so we put aside the whole question of is it civil or not civil. Then the question is it ethically or politically right or wrong, right?
Yeah.
And so let's not use the word civil for right and uncivil for bad, you know? And I think that that also is perspectival. From where I am in terms of my own political standpoint, an act is virtuous if it furthers the ends of ordinary people in society to have control over their lives. That's sort of my line. It's kind of like about radical democracy, ordinary people, their agency to control their lives. If it furthers that, then it's okay to do.
Okay.
Right? And also, if it's in defense of oneself, obviously, and oneself individually and collectively, right? A confrontation is a right thing to do.
Okay.
But then I think we do have to acknowledge that there is that spectrum of confrontations from sort of violence, terrorism on one end, to I'm trying to think of what would be on the other end, a complete non-confrontation on that end, but moving through petitioning and asking nicely, and then civil disobedience and so on, all the way through to the spectrum, right?
Sure.
And so every one of those points on that spectrum is a tool that people have used throughout history forwarding their aims. And people who are in power and people who are not in power do that.
Okay.
Am I making sense?
Yeah, that makes sense.
It's kind of like going meta on it, like, you know, basically saying, let's throw the concepts out of the window and ask ourselves what forms of confrontation are necessary and right.
Okay.
Mm. You mentioned the uncivil tongue. Can you just elaborate on how the uncivil tongue relates to polarization between parties or even on specific issues in America today?
Well, that's a good question. I am not the expert on negative political campaigns, but what's interesting to me as a phenomenon about elections is that the more the same the candidates get to each other, there are some big different disagreements between Republicans and Democrats and between Romney and Obama, but they're not that big. So the narrower, the closer people get to each other, the meaner they are. To each other, because you can't make a distinction. They're both pro-war, so Obama can't say, well, I'm anti-war, right? They're both pro-death penalty. So you can't make a real distinction, so what do? You make a style distinction. You make a ruckus, right? And so you do something that will spark controversy and cause antagonism, even though in reality there isn't that much antagonism. So that's what I'd say about the elections. I don't know if that helps. What was the other part of the question?
It was just on, like, political issues in general that are at the forefront.
About the uncivil tongue. Yeah, and I guess the point I'd like to make, again, is that every occasion of inequality is an occasion for the uncivil tongue. Like, take slavery, right? On an extreme end, right? The invitational rhetoric people might actually suggest that the slave sit down with the slaveholder and talk about the problem, right? However, when we recognize that there's a huge power imbalance, somebody has to say or do something that will be an affront, a confrontation. And so that person will be regarded, slave rebellions were regarded as uncivil, right? And inappropriate and even criminal, right? So in any situation where there's a gap in power, the person on the bottom will have to do things that the person on the top will say is uncivil.
It's true that that an oppressed group acting civil can aggravate the oppressors, such as like in the civil rights movement.
Mm-hmm.
Do you think that this also attracts moderates to side with the oppressed?
Oh, that's a really great question, like about the civil rights movement. I just taught a class on the civil rights movement. And I think really important, whenever the oppressed do something, it will generally, if not always, be regarded as uncivil by the oppressor, right? And so, thank you, because this brings up the polarization question, which I keep meaning to get to. So in the civil rights movement, when I have to say, in the segregated South, which is still somewhat segregated, but in the Jim Crow era, for a black person to do almost anything would be considered to be uncivil in public, in terms of transportation, housing, other facilities, speaking up speaking your mind, any of that would have been considered. So when Martin Luther King led the sit-ins into the street, it got in the way, it disturbed the peace, right? Or when people got on the buses and insisted that black people be seated alongside white people, or when they didn't get on the buses in the boycott, all of those things were regarded as hugely uncivil. And when Martin Luther, you should read Martin Luther King's letter from a Birmingham jail, because when Martin Luther King was in jail in Birmingham, Alabama, he basically says, all those clergy, all those politicians are telling me to be nice and to not be confrontational. And he said, and to wait and be patient. And he basically said that, well, famously he said, injustice delayed is, justice delayed is too often justice denied. So he said a lot of other famous things in there. But so he was definitely doing something that was regarded as uncivil, even though we remember the civil rights movements and the word civil disobedience, right? But what would happen in those actions is that it would provoke a response from the establishment, and oftentimes a violent response, and that antagonism would be then exposed to the world, right? Because what King always said was that he was trying to dramatize the relationship, right? And so if you do something, if you put it out there and somebody shoots you, then everybody knows that was an unequal relationship, right? Or put you in jail or whatever. So basically to enact that drama over and over again, and his purpose was indeed to polarize the American people, and basically, you know, you pick a side. You have to pick a side. Either you're with the racist or you're not. And because at some point you're with the people who lynch people, or you're with the people who fight against it. And so when you see that dramatized in that way, it can be very polarizing. But you can tell from what I just said that, I think that Martin Luther King, who's widely known for not being uncivil, was really uncivil. And B, that polarization is a good thing. I mean, in many situations. Not every situation, but in many situations.
One of the recurrent themes in the course is that, you know, for even radical social movements to get any kind of traction, they've got to win over the moderates. Mm-hmm. And I think traditionally, or I mean, there's at least in a lot of rhetorical theory, the notion of being civil is seen as a guise. You know, Martin Luther King was less radical than Malcolm X. He was seen as more civil than Malcolm X. And so the white people that might have been uncomfortable with a more radical civil rights philosophy were made more comfortable by Martin Luther King's more civil style. Is that an assessment? I mean, you presumably you sort of disagree with that assessment, but that question of sort of civility as being necessary to get moderates on board seems to be, one possible objection to the critique of civility that you've developed here.
I find it to be the opposite case. I'm teaching the rhetoric of social movements now, and I have it's really so much more complicated, and I'm sorry, but I mean, it's that, can you all see my hands?
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so when you're talking about a spectrum of civility and incivility, we can also call that the tactical axis. So people do moderate things and people do militant things, right?
Mm-hmm.
And usually they're different people, right? That is not the same thing as having the most radical ideas and the least radical ideas. I have an idea axis and a tactics axis. And some people who are doing the most peaceful things but espousing the most radical ideas will be regarded as completely uncivil and need to be shot, right? Mm-hmm. So it's at some point when your ideas are very radical, however nice you play, is not going to make any difference whatsoever. And the second point of disagreement would be, if you've read Bowers, Oakes, and Jensen's typology of the moments of the social movements, they basically say, and polarization comes in, that first people with a grievance will appeal to the system. When that gets denied, then they will try to recruit, and they will try to solidify their side. And to do that, you do not need to be moderate. In fact, you need people to be able to identify you as their side, so you need to be very clear. But then you have to take that organization that you've made and and do something with it, right? And that generates the need to win over a different kind of audience. But that process of winning over is not always a matter of being civil. One of my favorite moments from Eyes on the Prize is when Ossie Davis, who was the grandfather in The Cosby Show, if anybody, I mean, you're all too young to remember. But he was a member of the Nation of Islam, a radical separatist group in the 1960s. He said, he was in a meeting with some authorities, and he said, basically, the strategy is, I'm asking you real nicely, right? I want these reforms. We want these reforms. But I have to warn you that outside the door is the other brother. That's what he said, right? The other brother that is not going to be nice, right? And Herbert Haynes has this excellent concept, he was in SNCC, of flanking, which is this idea that in any social movement, a more radical dimension will come along and flank, that's your left, will flank the movement on its left. And therefore, this part of the movement suddenly looks way more moderate than it did before. So I think this idea of moderation appealing to the masses or to moderates is really perspectival and depends. Once that flank comes, once a more militant presence is there, a more unsupported presence, those people over here, they look super great to the establishment. And if you look at the history of civil rights reforms, those are the moments that trigger a kind of tipping point on some of those. Anyway, that's my working theory, but it's, so I'm sorry, I got kind of got, a digression, but.
That's great.
It's another instance of how the words civil and uncivil just can't capture what it is that is going on, you know? That we're talking about history, the unfolding of history, and making history go. And history doesn't go without confrontation. And that sounds kind of juvenile, but I mean, it's true. I mean, to get the wheel turning, you have to push it. And some people in the world are going to say, that was uncivil, that was uncalled for, that was inappropriate, right? But to the people who are on your side, it was very appropriate and necessary.
My question is, do you think society asks, is there a difference between genders on how much society asks a group or a person to be civil?
Absolutely. Absolutely. There's this great bracelet, I don't know if any of you have ever seen it, but it says, they make t-shirts and stuff, it says, well-behaved women rarely make history, right? And it's kind of a response to this idea that women are so often told that they should behave themselves. And from early childhood, gendering starts with the differences between inside and outside play, the differences in clothing choices. So boys can be rough and tumble, and girls are more physically passive. They are also verbally more passive. And then you're raised up in a system where gender difference is so central, and activity is on one side and passivity is on the other side in terms of the ideology. And so whenever a woman, I mean, today obviously we've made a lot of progress because of confrontation, but when women speak up assertively, sometimes that the idea that you should be civil is used as a way to keep that person to be quiet, because when people who are oppressed speak up, it violates the reality structure. You know, it's and people are gonna, and the word civility is used in a very gendered way, absolutely. And I think women are more often disciplined by it than men, which I think was part of the vitriol that came over that listserv toward me. I often wonder if I'd been male, kind of heading up this effort for the unconvention, whether it would have been seen as subversive.
Along with that, are there differences in social classes for standards?
That is so good. I mean, I could talk about so many things. that absolutely, yes. That in the history of capitalism, of our particular kind of economy, the division between owners, employers on the one hand and workers on the other is very stark. And obedience is part and parcel of working for someone. And so if you disrupt that process at all, not only will you be get called names, but you will maybe lose your job. And so there's a massive inequity there. So what happens when workers or when the people who are in the working class or who are poor decide to do something, they have the power of numbers and they have the economic power of the strike, which is serious confrontation. And that can make for cracks in kind of opening up voice for people who otherwise live a life that is highly constrained by the conditions of their work. But, I mean, it made me think so much about the labor movement and how always in the labor movement, the idea of striking or the idea of picketing is regarded as a form of violence. And so throughout American history, the cops, the National Guard, and federal troops have been called in over and over again to break up pickets by force if necessary, and often actually by force. So we're not talking just about conversation anymore. We're talking about power, right? And we're talking about what kinds of things give people voice when they don't have a lot of power. Because the powerful are going to say, be nice. And they have to say at some point, no, I'm not going to be nice. But sometimes if you do that, you get shot. And sometimes when you do that, you make history. So it's a judgment call all around. And so I guess this whole conversation for me totally unfolds into social movements. And I guess that's kind of what I'm getting at here, that a fully fleshed out democracy is one where there is controversy, confrontation, antagonism, and resistance that propels history forward. Otherwise, we'd just be living with the same oppressions all the time.
Well, I guess my question is oriented around the media. So in some ways, I mean, I think that the what we see on the talking head cable shows and whatnot is kind of bread and circus. Mm-hmm. And again, I love what you said earlier about how the closer they are in position, the more outlandish they have to make their
meaner,
distinctions.
The meaner, literally meaner, yeah.
Right. So, I mean, in some ways, though, the fact that there is so much confrontation, it seems like it's meaningless confrontation on a lot of cable television shows or on internet discussion forums and blogs and whatnot, that actually distracts us from more meaningful confrontations. Would you agree with that, or?
Sort of. I mean, I agree that sort of, those modes of information transmission, or that's not the word. I mean, those modes of engagement are very shallow. They can be, because what counts as facts, what counts as actual information, the kinds of arguments that are made, there's a lot of unreasonableness, casuistry, lying, and you know, we know the explosion of fact-checking is really crazy right now.
Mm-hmm.
However, I think that it's not meaningless, because the people who put out those programs, it's in their interest to distract us from the actual confrontations that should be going on. So what I'm saying is that those things are purposeful. They're not stupid. They're motivated. They have huge corporate interests behind them. They are representing interests that don't necessarily want people to be paying attention to where the real power and where the real differences are. So, you know what I mean? Like,
yeah.
So it's both shallow and extremely meaningful.
Right.
Since we're kind of circling back to the election, I wanted to ask, when we were talking about that great example you gave earlier with the teacher strike,
mm-hmm.
you said before that you'd like to see more incivility in the election, and you don't think there's enough presently. So I guess what would you kind of like to see? What do you think
rid of the word civility, actually, and I would say what I would like there to be is more clash between candidates, more ideological difference. But what, I mean, this goes into a whole other set of topics about the two-party system and its limits and how both candidates represent different sectors of the same interests. And so they can't diverge so wildly. And what I would like to see them is to, for them to diverge so wildly. I would like there to be a really serious choice to be made in an election. And if we were to have a really serious choice, and probably everybody thinks there already is a real serious choice, but if we were to have a choice between different people, that would mean that there would be a meaningful fight between them. And I think a meaningful fight, a meaningful clash, is what I mean by more incivility.
Okay. Do you think in a situation like that where you had two candidates hypothetically like differing on almost every issue, does that open up ground for more candidates in the mix?
I think so. I mean, we haven't seen it. I mean, because the control of campaign finance, with the Citizens United decision, I mean, corporations are people, and therefore money is speech. So corporations can give money endlessly to campaigns, and they do even-handedly different corporations between Democrats and Republicans. So there is a tight tether on how far astray the politicians can go. And in fact, the only thing that has ever changed how divergent politics can be is the presence of agitation on the ground among regular people. People don't know, for example, that Richard Nixon was way more liberal than Clinton or Obama. He wasn't my favorite dude, but he started the EPA. He extended welfare. He did, and the Environmental Protection Agency. He extended workplace benefits. I mean, he was out there, and it was only because in the late 60s and early 70s there were near revolutions, going on. So he had to do something, and I think that opened up that possibility. But I think if we got candidates that were really different between the two mainstream parties, which is unlikely, then the other parties would be able to have a more audible voice, because there would be a latitude, But when they're excluded from the debate, when they don't have any money, people say, oh, they don't matter, they can't win. Well, of course they can't win. They have no money and they have no voice. So it would be neat to see a situation where they could win. But
so, for instance, Mitt Romney, they talked about how he used to be more of a moderate, if not even more towards a Democrat. Then he went conservative and to get his candidacy. And now that he has that, they're saying he's a newborn moderate.
Mm-hmm.
And now that he's gone back more towards the moderate position, he's had a surge in the polls and it made it a much tighter race, which I think just goes to show that our society likes moderate and they don't like to see the extremes. And of course, you say you'd like to see more incivility. Whenever there's like a dirty race or if there's negative ads, people frown upon that.
Mm.
So will our society even ever allow for that kind of change to occur?
Well, again, I think it depends on who's in control. I mean, right now, I think the boundaries of what counts as choice in politics are so narrow right now, except on some social issues. That even Obama did not pursue when he was in office last time, or is in office this time. So what the two parties do is, depending on the level of struggle in society, public opinion polls, and so on, they'll peg themselves to one version of this narrow spectrum. And the Tea Party represents a kind of deviation from the mainstream conservative. So Romney wants to peg himself over there, even though in terms of his person or his history, he may not have identified there. But it's very strategic to try to stake out terrain, but the field is so small. And so people have to do weird things to stake out terrain. They have to lie. They have to try to appear much more radical than they are. Then they have to try to appear much more moderate than they are. Then, I thought the problem with Obama in the first debate, which obviously he lost, was that he could not distinguish himself from Romney. What is there to say, Go back and look at that and see what you think.
Well,
there's another reason, too, but that's off topic.
Well, how about social networking? Because you could argue that the internet and with social networking allows for people who who don't have a name for themselves to generate the name for themselves and really appeal to the younger voters in a quick fashion. So, you know, because social networking, would that be a way to stake out your terrain and have, you know, different views from the mainstream?
Yeah, you know, I think that social networking can give and has given other parties and other candidates some voice. I know that people in the last election, the election before, and so on, back to 2000, 2000 was a special case, but in many ways. But people today are recognizing the names of some of the third-party candidates more than they did. It's still a trickle, but one fellow I know was published an article on his blog that basically said, what we need to do if we're interested in alternatives is to start using the social media to get ourselves together to see if we can raise the resources in order to intervene more effectively in elections. And so in the terms of social movements, that's the stage called solidification, is when you get your own act together, when you get your people together and you get your resources together. And I think social media are good for that. But of course, in terms of challenging a structure or a system, it's pretty fragmented. So you would have to actually get those people together and then mobilize them to do something. Mm-hmm. So I think we're in the early stages of the social media thing. I mean, I'd like to see, I know everybody thinks it's been around for a long time, but I think we're just in the early stages to see what its political possibilities are. Mm-hmm. If they don't get completely shut down. Because, you know, surveillance is a big problem online. I mean, you know this already, but on all the social media, the state and a number of corporations have access to your data. So what you think is a agentive tool has a double edge. And then there's, so that's one thing I'll just mention.